Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
After a few weeks of panel discussions and multi-person debates, we return to our normal format of one-on-one discussions this week. To that end, today I am joined by Professor Marcus Schaefer, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Toronto. Dr. Schaefer received his PhD in sociology at Purdue University and obtained his undergraduate education at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. Marcus specializes in a number of different research areas, including aging and the life course, medical sociology, which sounds really yucky, physical and mental health, social psychology, inequality, social networks, and the sociology of religion. It will be those latter two topic areas, social networks and religion, that will be the focus of our discussion today, since all that talk about medical stuff gets me queasy, so we're going to stay away from that. Professor Schaefer is the recipient of a number of very well-financed grants, mostly for his work on health topics. I guess that's where all the money is. And he has published over 4 dozen articles in journals as varied as Social Forces, American Journal of Sociology, Social Psychology Quarterly, Journal for the Social Scientific Study of Religion, Journal of Aging and Health, and The Gerontologist, which I suppose should be on my nightstand for reading, given that my beard is getting kind of gray. Well, back in 2010, Professor Schaefer won the Rising Star Award for Excellence in Aging Research at Purdue University's Center on Aging and the Life course. And that's kind of ironic that they gave that to a young person. They should have given it to older people who get a later start in life. So, and young people get all this stuff. That's okay. Anyways, I recently had the great pleasure to meet with Marcus whilst up at the University of Toronto, and we served on a panel together on academic freedom and expression at Wycliffe College on that campus. Big shout out to Wycliffe. It was fun being up there. Hope to see you folks again. And Marcus, thanks for taking time to be with us on Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
You were at Purdue in Indiana and then Grove City in Pennsylvania. Now you've moved to Toronto. So my number one question is, how are you adjusting to all that Celsius and other metric system stuff?
I've actually come to enjoy the Celsius metric. It makes a lot of sense to me that zero would be the sort of freezing point. That seems to actually become more intuitive over time. But I will admit that when I get behind the wheel of a car, I have to be really careful with the kilometer versus miles per hour thing.
Yeah, that can be kind of dangerous for Americans. I know when I'm making my Tim Horton runs up in Vancouver, I just kind of ignore all that stuff and hope that the police don't get me.
I have found that they are not so good-willed down in the state of New York.
All right. Anyways, our focus today is going to be on religious networks and more specifically social networks that might contain some religious folks within them, and how that also affects a variety of social outcomes. But I want to start by asking you how you became interested in such a broad range of study topics. You encompass everything from aging to religion. And given your interest in gerontology and old people, it just doesn't seem like this would be this broad range of research that any young person would want to take up. So, studying old people, they're all cranky and stinky. So what gives with this research agenda you have?
Yeah, I guess I have to admit the research agenda has kind of been full of a lot of twists and turns. I could just start from the beginning, how I got interested in gerontology and studying aging to begin with. So I had been interested in studying health issues, and I had chosen to go to Purdue University to pursue a PhD in sociology there to study health. And I didn't know it really much at the time, but my advisor, who I was going to go study with, was also the director of the Gerontology Center there at Purdue. And he had just sort of struck up this interesting partnership with this retirement community in the town of West Lafayette, Indiana, where Purdue University is. And they had sort of struck up this really interesting arrangement where they would have PhD students from Purdue Gerontology come and live in this retirement community, basically to give them exposure to see what it's like to age, to give them opportunities to do firsthand research on site, And my advisor proposed this to me as I was preparing to come to West Lafayette, Indiana. And admittedly, I didn't really have a place to live at that point. I wasn't kind of so gung-ho on doing an extensive apartment search. And I thought, well, this would open up sort of a new world to me of things I'd never seen before, different living arrangements, to say the least, maybe not a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, maybe a twice-in-a-lifetime opportunity, presuming I live a long time. But I thought, you know, what the heck, we'll try it out. So I ended up taking on a year lease living in this retirement community affiliated with the Purdue Gerontology Center. And that was a really amazing opportunity, and I really learned a lot from it. I learned a whole lot about aging. I never knew any grandparents when I was growing up. None of them were in my life. And so I suddenly had, you know, about 200 independent living resident grandparents who quickly acclimated me to the life of retirement living, and I enjoyed that so much. I decided to actually go back several years later to conduct my dissertation research there and study social networks among people in this retirement community. And that sort of spawned a whole other set of interests that I had as well in sort of extending social networks to the study of religion and so on.
Yeah, how did the interest in religion come up from gerontology? I mean, for somebody as young as you are in your career as an assistant professor, it's amazing that you have so many different streams of research going on. I mean, that's a great sign of a active intellect. But how did religion come onto your radar?
Well, I guess it was part of the issue. I just can't really sit still too much. I'm always kind of excited to sort of peer into other areas of sociology or other areas of social science. And so I had started studying, you know, networks among older people, and I really focused on that for a few years. And then I kind of always had this sort of side interest in congregational life and American religiosity and the role that a religion plays in Americans' lives. And so I just thought that was maybe a way I could just sort of veer off my path of aging in networks and sort of take the study of networks in a little bit of a different direction, and just build in a little bit of that interest that I had in religion into studying networks as well. So it was kind of a study of branching off and just sort of starting up a new sort of set of side projects.
Well, you've mentioned networks and network analysis a couple times here, and that's a growing industry within sociology and the social sciences in general. Some of our listeners might not be so familiar with what networks and network sociology is, so give us a little bit of background before we get into the religion stuff.
Yeah, so the study of networks is basically just this idea that we can best really understand social life by looking at the connections between people, rather than just focusing on people sort of as individual actors and study, you know, up and down all the traits or characteristics of people themselves. Understanding how people are connected to one another really sheds a lot more light on how we live our social lives. So there's a couple streams of research that I think have been really influential that has sort of sparked my interest and my curiosity in understanding these sort of properties of connectedness and why they matter. One is this really fascinating project that was undertaken by a couple of social scientists launched a few years ago, and they still continue doing it. It's the idea that we're really influenced by the people that we're connected to. And so the people that I'm referring to are the sociologist Nicholas Christakis and political scientist James Fowler, and they've really taken this really unique set of data that was collected back in Massachusetts back in the 70s, and they followed these people over several decades. And what they argue from their data is that things as disparate as obesity, the smoking, the loneliness, even to divorce, sort of gets passed through and transmitted. Those norms of behavior get transmitted through social influence from one person to the next in social networks. So who we're connected to ultimately in some way shapes our behaviors, our health behaviors, and even our marital behaviors, they would argue. And they would even say that the effects can ripple up to 3 degrees of separation. So not only do you influence your friends or your friends' friends, but even perhaps your friends' friends' friends. So it's a really profound idea, I think, about how the way that we're connected to each other really can transmit social influence. And so that was a really interesting idea that was really been really moving the field forward over the last decade or so. But another, I think, classic idea about why social networks matter and why they're interesting to study is that social relationships have value. They can promote things that matter to us, good things in our lives. So, for instance, if you think about the people you're connected to, they can be really important to helping, you know, find a job, find a romantic partner, finding healthcare options that you might need. People and connections help us you know, feel that we belong to something. So if we're part of a network, that can foster the sense of belonging and mattering to other people. And what really first got me interested in networks to begin with is that it can really be good for our health. There was a really fascinating study done a couple years ago from some folks out at Brigham Young University. They did a meta-analysis. That means they looked at over 100 studies, a sort of massive collection of international studies that show this link between strong social relationships and health and mortality. And they find that having strong social relationships is actually associated with as much as a 1.5 times higher survival rate year to year compared with people that have weak or poor social relationships. And they argue that being isolated or not being connected is basically equivalent to something like smoking 15 cigarettes a day or being an alcoholic or not exercising, and even more harmful is, say, being obese for survival and long-term health. So I thought those were really, you know, powerful perspectives on why individuals benefit from being connected. And then even there's an argument even, too, that value generated by social networks doesn't just extend to individuals, but also helps community life as a whole. It sort of fosters social capital in neighborhoods and communities. So the political scientist Bob Putnam has done a lot of work on looking at social capital in communities. When there's a dense interconnection of relationships in communities and neighborhoods, kids tend to do better in school, there tend to be lower crime rates, there tend to be even more economic growth. And so there seems to be that the trust and the sort of ways that we can police each other and sort of use the sort of sense of social control to promote good ends can really be, again, profoundly helpful for communities.
Well, that's something we're going to dig into right now with talking about religion, because you know, religions, people who are religious tend to congregate into groups, and those are networks. I have a quick question, though. You brought up something about difference between strong relations and weak relationships. What does that actually mean and look like? Does a strong relationship mean somebody that I see every day and hang out with for an hour, or what?
Yeah, so I guess the what I was talking about a few minutes ago with that particular study about strong relationships versus people that are more isolated or have only weak relationships, that I guess distinction would be important in that people that have people they feel they can talk to about important things in their lives, they can go to if they have, if they need help, that they can rely upon if they need assistance or advice. That seems to be a really big distinction between having at least some people in your life that you're connected to in that way versus being completely isolated. But there's another type of a network connection that is, I think, relevant. Maybe you're talking about or inferring is that there's the distinction sometimes network analysts make between strong ties, ties that are usually between people that are like you, people that sort of share maybe your same socioeconomic standing, that are similar to you in terms of your race or ethnicity. Similar to you in many of those ways. We sometimes refer to those as strong ties that sort of bond together, like-minded people. But the other kind of tie or connection that's really important in society is something we call a weak tie. It's sort of a tie that doesn't have that emotional resonance, per se, or doesn't really have that strong emotional bond, but nevertheless, through an acquaintanceship or through a knowledge of other people, sort of connects you to other groups in society, so people that are maybe not like you. And so sometimes people talking about the way that connections foster social capital or value would say that there's bonding social capital, but there's also bridging social capital. So knowing of people outside of your own inner circle is also really valuable because it can connect you then to other whole pools of information or potential cooperation with people that aren't the same as you.
Okay, so that brings us to the stuff that you've done on religion. You've done a number of articles on religion and social networks that leverage this really interesting data set, and we're going to explore some of those. One of these is a recently published article that came out in the journal Social Currents back in 2015, and you examined whether or not religiously traditional people were more pro-social than other folks using this network analysis. Let's walk through that. First of all, what is pro-social behavior?
So pro-social behavior, I guess I would take a pretty broad definition of what is pro-social. One of the definitions that I think I used in the paper is that pro-social behavior is the broad range of actions that's intended to benefit one or more people other than oneself. That can include things like helping, comforting, sharing, and cooperating. So that sort of broad vision of what pro-social behavior is could encompass things like, you know, volunteering down at the soup kitchen, you know, volunteering maybe as a soccer coach for your daughter, donating money to needs, but it could also refer to sort of, I think, being a good neighbor to people, offering help or assistance, advice, practical help to people in your community, to extended family members. So it's really this sort of idea of trying to do things for other people without any kind of explicit anticipation of being rewarded for it or being paid back for it. Of course, it's really hard sometimes to sort of say that people do good things for others purely out of these altruistic motivations. It's never possible, I don't think, to completely root out the fact that people could enjoy or get a sort of psychological lift from helping other people. But at least these are sort of things where there isn't any sort of explicit expectation that they're being paid back for it.
Yeah. Even as a rational choice economist like myself, I do recognize that there are these altruistic and giving type of behaviors that we often engage in without expecting anything in return. And I think this research is actually pretty interesting. A lot of people have studied pro-social behaviors in a variety of different contexts. You take a look at religiously traditional folks in comparison to a few others, religious non-traditionalists and seculars as well. Give us an idea of what you mean by religiously traditional folks and why you put the focus on them in your study.
Yeah, so I think that people that we could identify as religious traditionalists are really interesting sort of from a big picture vantage point. There's been a lot of debate maybe over the past, you know, decade or so, even, you know, going back further than that, but it's sort of, I think, come to the surface a lot more in the last decade or so, especially with the book Religion Poisons Everything, written by Christopher Hitchens and some other sort of vocal advocates from the new atheist movement have really sort of started, you know, in some ways said that, you know, it's not a good thing that we have people that really hold fast to these sort of traditional tenets of traditional religiosity, whether it's, you know, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, that maybe there are some downsides for society that people sort of still take really seriously these religious traditions. And from that, there's been sort of a lot of study, and it certainly predates those certain books, but there's been a lot of study about trying to assess, you know, people that take religion really seriously, especially in its traditional forms, are they, do they bring good to society, do they bring benefit and value to their communities, or are they actually people that foster intolerance and discrimination and sort of hold back or retard process and progress in society? And so the way I would simply, I guess, define what religious traditionalism is sociologists have kind of pointed to a number of markers of this phenomenon. One is that they see traditionalism as being this sort of belief that God is this ultimate arbiter of good and evil, that good and evil and morality is not culturally relative, that it's not sort of different from one society to the next over time, but that there is some kind of, at root, some kind of black and white, right or wrong, that's mandated by God himself, that God is the author of good and evil, defines what those things are. Secondly, that Scripture is authoritative for the life of the believer, that Scripture isn't just sort of a collection of nice ideas or fairy tales or legends, but that's actually divinely inspired and authoritative in the lives of adherents. And so people should take seriously what the Bible says. That should be the sort of guidance for their life and what they do. And then thirdly, another sort of tenet of traditionalism is this idea that God is actively engaged in human activity, that his hand is on our world, that he's concerned with what we do. He isn't just the sort of deistic figure that sort of lets the clock run and then stands back, but he's actually intimately involved in what people do and cares about that, what people do. And so those sort of three tenets of traditionalism can apply to, you know, Catholics, to Protestants, to traditionalist Jews, to Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox believers, various different traditions. And so the argument that some sociologists have made is the front line of the culture wars, where we sort of see these debates in society about how religion figures into society, whether it's holding back progress or whether it's good for society. Really, the divisive fault line really is this distinction between more modernist believers who perhaps are more accommodating towards modernity, who are more progressive in their views, who don't hold those sort of three tenets the way that traditionalists do, and between traditionalists across different faith traditions. So whether you're a traditionalist Catholic or a traditionalist Protestant or a traditionalist Eastern Orthodox believer, you have more in common in terms of advocating this traditionalist view of religion relative to more progressive or more mainline type of believers in society.
And I can see how a lot of people would argue that these traditionalists tend to isolate themselves in rather insular communities. And that's one of the things that you're examining here. You know, those traditionalist folks, they don't like those secular people, so they hang out with folks who like Jesus like the way that they like Jesus. And you're testing that. I know there's some evidence on the other side. We've had Brad Wright here and Rod Stark on previous podcasts talking about that as well. So how do you use social network theory to dive in and test the difference between these different hypotheses and whether traditionalists are pro-social or antisocial?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, there is this whole rhetoric behind sort of, you know, traditionalists being insular and being cut off and sort of in sort of bunkering down in their sort of own closed-knit communities and sort of shutting themselves off from others. And there's this whole reverse rhetoric, too, about these divisive culture wars where people on various sides of social issues are just lodging bombs at each other, not actually talking to one another, not actually engaging. And so one of the kind of things I was hoping to do with this article is just sort of maybe question that assumption a little bit and peel back and sort of see what's actually happening in the data. And so I'm starting with the premise that there are traditionalists in American society. There are people who would hold these traditional perspectives on their religious faith. But I want to ask, you know, how common are they in people's close networks, people's own personal networks, the people that individuals would identify as their close friends or their close family members? How common is it that people will actually identify traditionalists as part of those close personal networks? And then, you know, of those close personal people that are in, of those traditionalists that are in people's close networks, are they more likely or less likely than other types of folks to provide help and assistance and do good things to them, be good neighbors or be good extended family members?
So you set out to do this with a very interesting data set and some interesting methodological techniques. Go ahead and, you know, give us the non-wonky version of what this data, what these data are and how you're going to go around and test this stuff.
Yeah, so the data I used, and this is, I guess, maybe one of these instances where sometimes the tools or the sort of data that are available sort of provoke you and prod you to go into a particular direction for research. So a few months ago, we were talking about how I got interested in studying religion and networks, and this was actually one of the driving forces as well of how I got interested. There was this data set that came out that was conducted in 2006 called the Portraits of American Life Study, and this particular survey sort of opened up a whole new opportunity to study networks and religion together that really wasn't available in any previous sets of data in the U.S. This is a survey that was conducted back in 2006, and there was another follow-up wave of it. There was a sort of tracking of the participants over time. But it started during this 2006 period as an attempt to try to understand the role of religion in the everyday life of Americans and its influence on social behaviors and attitudes. And one of the kind of neat things about this survey was that they asked people about their close personal network. They specifically asked people to identify four people who were outside their home that they felt closest to really identify them by name, to actually identify who these people were. And they said that it could be friends, coworkers, neighbors, relatives, or really anyone else that doesn't live with you. And this is a sort of way that people, we can put together a network. So if I ask you, you know, to identify your four closest people, and then you identify them by initial or by name, then they'd ask you as a follow-up, you know, what is the education of those people? Are they similar in age to you? Do they live close by to you? So there were all these sort of follow-up questions. But one of the really unique things that the Portraits of American Life study does that no other surveys do is they ask people specifically about the religious content of those ties that they have to these people. What is their religion of those people that you know? Do they do things for you, like pray for you or talk about religious things with you or spiritual things with you? So they kind of dive into this whole religious side of social connection, which a lot of other surveys and social scientists just really kind of ignore. So this is kind of a first attempt to actually explore this topic in any kind of systematic, nationally representative way.
Yeah, that's really, that's really kind of neat because, as you mentioned, a lot of social scientists still kind of operating from a secularization mindset, say, yeah, that religion doesn't matter. We're not going to ask about that. Or even if it's sitting there in the survey, you just kind of brush those things aside to look at other more important variables. But you're pretty prescient. You grabbed these things and took a look at them.
Yeah, exactly. I was really fascinated with them, so I picked them up and ran with them. One of the questions that really caught my eye was they asked people, those, you know, individuals you named, those four people, which of those hold beliefs that are religiously conservative or traditional? And that was kind of a way into perhaps capturing the sort of religious traditionalism of the ties that people have. Now, I should mention that that isn't in any way a sort of perfect way to try to assess the traditionalism of, you know, your close personal connections. You know, for one, you might not know exactly what the religion or religious preference is of those ties that you have. It could be that you're sort of guessing and you're sort of maybe pulling together what you know about the person, trying to sort of gauge whether they are religiously traditional or conservative. But I'm trying to operate under the assumption here that people do have a pretty good idea about the religious beliefs of those four really close people in their lives. But nevertheless, it's certainly imperfect information. And, you know, the definition of what is religiously traditional or conservative might vary from person to person, right? You might have a different definition of that than I would. But nevertheless, I think it is somewhat of a rough proxy for identifying those people who are we could call traditionalists. They also asked whether there were people that were non-religious at all. So we can kind of differentiate three different groups, sort of traditionalist religious people, people who are religious to some degree but not traditionalist, more progressive or more mainline in their religious beliefs, and then people who are non-religious altogether. And then they sort of followed up with another series of questions about these network ties. They asked them, the respondents, during the past 3 years, which of these people volunteered to help you in times of need? Which of these people provided advice that helped you make an important decision? So again, advice that actually was helpful, not necessarily just offering advice to no end. And then finally, that as a third question they asked, which of these people have ever helped you by giving you money or a loan? So the intent of this study then was to sort of match up and say, okay, you know, of these different types of religion that these ties could be, does the religious nature of that tie have any impact on whether or not they provided these particular forms of good behavior to the respondent?
You've already mentioned some of the limits of the study, defining who is a traditionalist and asking somebody else to define that in their own terms. Are there any other limitations on this study? I find this kind of an interesting study. You're asking about four different people who are close to you. And, you know, I'm just wondering if people are making up stuff or, you know, what they're doing. How is this kind of PALS data set looked at in general? Are there any other limits on this thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's definitely pluses and minuses, I think, for any kind of survey data set to use. I think that's a sort of really important lesson, just broadly speaking, with any kind of social scientific attempt to study religion. One of the major limitations I would note as well, beyond just sort of having to report on the basis of your close associate, would be this issue of PALS is a nationally representative study of Americans, right? So they're interviewing about 2,600 American people, so it sort of follows the traditions of probability sampling. We make sure that we're representing the entire American population. But when you start asking then about people's networks, close personal networks, that set of people isn't necessarily nationally representative, right? So if I, you know, interview 2,600 people and ask them about their network ties, that pool of network ties are the people that happen to be nominated as network members of this nationally representative sample. So in other words, there might be a whole lot of people who don't make their way into people's close networks, perhaps because they're just really misanthropic, they're really unpleasant people, they're not helpful people at all, perhaps. And so we could be kind of getting at maybe a distorted picture of the religious traditionalists in people's networks if there are two types of traditionalists. Maybe there really are super helpful, good-natured, pro-social types of traditionalists, but maybe there's also a whole other set, sort of in a bimodal distribution, a whole other set of people who are on the opposite extreme, who are completely non-helpful. And those people would never even make their way into the networks to begin with. So we kind of have a censored observation there. We don't actually have any way to actually assess potentially the bad apples of the mix.
Yeah. It is kind of a neat survey, though, and, you know, methodologically speaking, for those folks who are not into the social sciences, you have to go to analysis with the data that you get, and it's not always perfect, but sometimes you can get some really, really cool insights from stuff, recognizing those various limitations, and that's exactly what you do here.
Well, one thing I wanted to mention as well, if I could just start to interject, but one issue, too, I should mention that one of the major problems with a lot of existing research on pro-social behavior is that we're asking people themselves. We're saying, okay, Tony, did you volunteer at the soup kitchen in last year?
Yeah.
You know, did you give any money to the local veterinarian office in the past year or whatever? You know, we're asking you. And if you're a person that is a religious traditionalist and you take seriously these commandments of Scripture to be a good neighbor and to love thy neighbor as thyself and all these other injunctions, we might have reason to be a little bit suspect of whether you're actually telling the truth on all of those or being completely honest when it comes to reporting how good a boy you've been, right? But if we can actually ask you to not report on your own behavior, but to actually report on those people who are part of your network, there might not be that same type of self-serving bias. And so that might actually give us maybe a different insight into pro-social behavior. You're recounting the deeds of your network members, not of your own behavior.
Yeah, that is a really cool technique that's been developed over the past few decades. I know they do this with drug research and sex research. They don't ask you if you've done things because you never do anything bad, but it's the person next to you, and you're willing to spill the beans on them a little bit more honestly. So I think that's a very cool technique that you're leveraging there with this data set. Let's go ahead and jump into some of the findings now, and some of them are pretty interesting. Again, we're trying to see if religious traditionalists are somewhat insular and antisocial, or if they exhibit pro-social behaviors here via their networks. So give us what you found.
Yeah, so one thing I was actually a little bit surprised with was the sort of extent to which traditionalists sort of have found themselves into the networks of even relatively non-religious people. So as a whole, in this Powell's sample of people, this over 2,000 people in the United States, about 70% said they had at least one person in their network that was construed as a religious traditionalist. So this includes, of course, people who are religious. Many Americans, of course, themselves are religious, but it also includes people who aren't very religious. And so what I try to actually break this down by looking at respondents who say that their religion isn't important to them at all, or people that don't go to church. And what I find actually kind of interesting is that even among people who say that they're not at all themselves religious, about 57% or so of them still say that they have at least one person in their close personal network who themselves is a religious traditionalist. As you'd expect, you know, people who say that religion is really important to them, or people who identify as, you know, very conservative in their religious orientation, or people who go to church regularly, they have upwards of 80% of them would say that they have at least one traditionalist. But the fact that even among the sort of less religious, that you see these sort of, you know, pretty high rates, to me was actually kind of a surprising finding.
Yeah, I should note, too, and this just kind of came to mind, we were talking about the methodological limits a moment ago, and you said there might be a bias toward religious traditionalists who are more outgoing and willing to connect into networks. That's actually true with seculars as well, too. There are probably some secular folks who, you know, go out and want to meet everybody and hang out with a lot of people, but there's also probably the secular hermit folks that are living in their basements just like religious traditionalists, and they would be filtered out of this survey. So, interestingly, you'd kind of expect that bias to work in both directions, but you still see a lot of religious traditionalists, even though they're about 30% of the population or so in the United States, connecting to about 60 or so percent of these networks.
Yeah, that was something I was actually a little bit surprised about.
Yeah. Okay, so these religious traditional folks, we're looking here in terms of your dependent variables or things you're trying to explain here. Do they give emotional support to other people? Do they a shoulder to cry on, so to speak? Do they give advice, helpful advice to other people? Do they give money to people? So what do you find? Are they helping out?
Yeah, so actually I find pretty consistently across the board that people are more likely to end up getting practical help, useful advice, and money from people who are traditionalists relative to people that are non-traditionalists, more progressive or more mainline type of religious adherence, and also similarly to people that are non-religious. And what was kind of interesting about this finding was I tried to break it down beyond just that sort of mere, sort of simple relationship. I also tried to say and ask, you know, is it the case that, you know, those traditionalists really are only providing or more likely to provide these various forms of social support if the recipient themselves is highly religious or if they're traditional in their views? And it turns out that there does seem to be some effect that if you are yourself a very religious person, that really enhances all the more the likelihood that traditionalist in your network will give you help, will give you advice, which you'd expect, perhaps, you know, if you're a really religious person and there's similarity with this network tie, they're also, say, very religious or they're a traditionalist, maybe like you are. The advice might, you know, make more sense getting it from them than it would be from somebody that didn't share your worldview whatsoever. But nevertheless, what's really interesting, I think, is that people, even people who are relatively a-religious, people who don't go to church, people who say that religion is not at all important to them, even among that group of people, there seems to be some impact of the traditionalism of that religious tie increasing the odds that they're going to be giving you advice and help. And what was kind of interesting as well is that for giving money, there wasn't really any evidence that traditionalists were more likely to give money to those people who shared their particular emphasis on religion in their life, that there wasn't really any kind of interaction there at all, that whether you were, as a recipient, a-religious, very religious, or somewhere in between, having a traditionalist tie was really associated with a greater likelihood of getting money from that person relative to whether it was not a religious traditionalist. It also held among both sort of kin members and non-kin members. So if we look sort of across some of these outcomes, you know, for getting money, for instance, you're much more likely to get money from a family member, an extended family member outside of your household than you would be from someone that wasn't related to you at all. So, you know, whether it's, you know, your uncle or your grandparent or your adult child, people are more likely to get money from kin members. But even among kin members, if that kin member happens to be a religious traditionalist, they're more likely to have given you money in the past 3 years than someone who is a non-traditionalist kin member. The same holds for those different outcomes and non-kin. So you're more likely to get advice from a non-kin religious traditionalist relative to somebody that's not a religious traditionalist. So it really held in, I think, a pretty remarkably robust way across all of these different variations, both in terms of the makeup of the recipient themselves and whether we're talking about a family member or a non-family member for the network tie.
Yeah, I found these results rather interesting, too. The one with giving money, you know, kin came out as a statistically significant variable, as you would expect. You tend to give money to your brothers and sisters, and plus you tend to ask for them, too. You don't ask from your best friends and things like that, and there's a lot of economic reasons behind that. But the issues of providing emotional support and for help, I found that interesting, because as I kind of think through the dynamics here, you know, where do you give emotional support? I would expect traditionalists to give support to other traditionalists, because it usually happens at church. That's when you notice people and you're talking about things other than work or about the traffic or the weather. You're talking about deeper philosophical issues, and you say, hey, you know, Marcus, I see you're kind of sad today. How are things going? Oh, yeah, having, you know, problems on the home front or something like that. And then you kind of give that kind of advice. But it's surprising that this happens between traditionalist and the, you know, non-traditionalist mainline or secular individuals as well.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised to that as well. I mean, there's one sort of idea that's floating in the literature called the minimal pro-sociality thesis, the sort of pro-sociality of really religious people or really traditionalist types of people. It's there, but it's minimal. It's really directed only to people that are like you. It's the sort of bonding social capital. To go back to that terminology, it's really only to enhance the sort of in-group dynamics, and it's not really outward-looking. And so what I think these results kind of are suggesting is that, you know, if you're seeking advice or you need help or you have some kind of, you're at a crossroads in your life and you need some kind of assistance, you know, if the choice is between, say, even, you know, your uncle who is a religious traditionalist and your uncle who is not one of those types of people, these data suggest that you're probably more likely to end up going to the traditionalist, all else being equal.
So you see that pattern in the data, and that's kind of interesting. Do you have any kind of explanations for why this might have turned out the way it has?
I think there's a couple different, you know, potential explanations. I think the findings are kind of open to interpretation to some degree. I mean, one idea, maybe the simplest, maybe the one that traditionalists would like to promote the most, would be that traditionalism promotes good behavior, right? If you believe that scriptural commands to love your neighbor as yourself if you take them really seriously and you think that there's a God that's going to hold you accountable for those behaviors, then that's going to foster this sort of good behavior. Perhaps you look to Scripture and you see the sort of models of sacrifice, and if you really embrace and identify with those sort of that sort of scriptural pattern, then maybe you yourself are more likely to take time to go help a neighbor, to offer advice, you know, at 2 a.m, to give money to a family member that's in need. So that's maybe one interpretation of it, that sort of traditionalism does foster sort of pro-sociality. Another potential explanation could be not the sort of social, not the sort of causation story, but that's more a story of selection. Maybe it could be that people that who are do-gooders, people that want to do a lot of good for their neighbor, perhaps they're drawn to more traditionalist types of religious expression. Maybe they end up more in those types of congregations or in those types of faith traditions. That's potentially an explanation. I think that could be entertained. But there's a couple maybe other, maybe more methodologically driven explanations as well. It could be that people simply impute traditionalism to those people that help them. So if you're your uncle Ned is just vaguely religious in your mind, but he ends up giving you money or ends up offering help, helping you move across town, maybe you're going to impute a more conservative traditionalism to your uncle Ned than you otherwise would. That's potentially an explanation. I don't know that I necessarily buy that, because there's a lot of evidence, I think, that shows that many people actually sort of have a distaste in their mouth for religious traditionalism. They don't necessarily associate good behavior with traditionalism or helping with traditionalism. So I don't think there necessarily is a strong incentive or a strong motive for people to identify good, helpful, loving behavior necessarily with traditionalism per se. So I'm not so keen on that explanation, but it is a possibility. And as I mentioned before, it could be that, because we're looking at the networks of a nationally representative sample, that we're actually getting a biased view of who these people are. And so maybe there are sort of really two extreme types of traditionalists, the really helpful ones who manage to find their way into these people's networks, and then a whole other set of misanthropic hermit types that just don't seek to do good for their neighbors at all, and those people are systematically excluded. Now we have to assume, of course, then that type of person is much more pronounced than the sort of secluded non-traditionalists, as you raised the issue before. We're also excluding in this set of data the sort of secularists who are not identified as part of people's networks as well. So I don't necessarily think that that's a strong argument, because there probably are people who are of all sorts of religious persuasions that aren't in people's networks. I don't have reason to believe that they're more likely to be traditionalists than others.
Yeah, interesting points. When I was reading through this article as well, too, I guess I was somewhat surprised about the pre-existing insularity or antisocial hypothesis about traditionalists, and many who you'd throw into the evangelical camp, because in fitting with your first explanation that a lot of evangelical or traditionalist beliefs motivate these kind of behaviors, there's this thing that you're supposed to go out and share the word of God with everybody. And I know, sitting in my own church, they tell you, here's ways you can go meet people at the gym or to open up a conversation about God or something like that. So there does seem to be this kind of push to interact with the world, at least that's been in my experience, and to build connections. And this leads us to your next paper that you use this PALS data set with, in terms of not only pro-social behavior, but making connections between individuals and kind of triangulating. If I know somebody in church, but I know somebody who's not in church, I'm going to connect that person who's not in church with that person who I know in church. And you have this great name for this that I'm probably going to get twisted up on my tongue here, but it's called transcongregational triadic closure. Yeah, that's a phrase for the ages. What is going on with transcongregational triadic closures?
Yeah, that term, maybe it looks a lot better on paper than it does actually saying it out loud. As I heard you sort of try to spit that set of words out, yeah, that's not a very sellable phrase. Perhaps if it was to be marketed by the church growth expert, they'd probably find a better, snazzier title for it. But anyway, a triad is basically any set of three persons, and a triadic closure process is the process of triangles forming in these groups of people. So let's take, a triad of people. We've got three people, you and two friends. And we could think about one circumstance where each of those friends, but they themselves don't know one another. It's sort of, we could call that sort of an unclosed triangle in this triad. Triadic closure would be the sort of process where that triangle gets closed, where your two friends themselves become friends. So friends of friends become friends, basically. That's the sort of essence of triadic closure. And so I was interested in this idea of, if you know friends that are part of your congregation that are rooted in your church life, are you likely then to connect that friend or have that a friendship form or a connection between someone that you know outside of church, someone that's not a church-based relationship? And so I refer to this sort of process as trans-congregational triad closure, sort of the closing of that triangle of relationships.
So what are the findings that you find here? Are religious people, religious traditionalists, are they ones to likely close these triangles? Are they not likely to close them? Are there certain geographic regions where they're easier closed than others? What's going on?
Yeah, so basically the way that this, you know, this article, particular article gets set up is that, you know, we live in a big world of 7.5 billion people, right? And triadic closure is one of the ways that we manage to make our world relatively small, right? Besides there being such a huge world, we live in ourselves in pretty small worlds. So there's a pretty good chance, usually, that our friends, you know each other. Many of our relationships tend to take on pretty tight clusters. But the sort of question I was looking at here was that, nevertheless, you know, not all of our close connections are themselves closely connected. There's something called, oftentimes, these structural holes in our network. There's these sort of lack of connections between our friends. So there's this sort of possibility that that triangle could get closed, or there's a possibility that it could remain unclosed. And so I was really interested in sort of studying among congregants in American, in United States church life, you know, who are the types of people who are likely to have those connections form between their church friends and their non-church friends. And so I, you know, basically looked at a couple different factors that could explain this triadic closure in those people's networks. One is that your religious tradition could have something to do with it. So as we were sort of talking about before, there is one sort of thesis about sort of evangelicals or sort of more conservative Protestants, especially in the United States, that they tend to have this sort of hunker-down mentality, that they sort of create these fortresses in their church. When they do good, it tends to be things just for their church friends, that they volunteer, but it's mostly singing in the choir or pastoring the offering plate. It's not necessarily venturing out and doing good in the broader community. And so one idea could be that people that are especially conservative Protestants, that sort of part of this tradition of maybe evangelicalism, that sort of strain of traditionalism in the United States, would be less likely than other types of religious traditions to make those, forge those connections, have a connection between their church relationships and relationships outside of church. So perhaps maybe they have someone in their network who's an extended family member. Maybe they have, you know, an adult child that's not part of their church, who's moved several states away, that's more secular, and they count that person as an important person in their life. But then they have their church friends who they really invest their time in. Those are the people that they spend their time building up and hanging out with. That's one possibility, but the other possibility that I think is probably more plausible, and it seems like it actually plays out much more in the data, is that people who are conservative Protestants especially, or evangelicals, they're more likely than other faith traditions to actually connect those different spheres of their life. So they might have a friend at work, they might have, buddies that they go to the gym with, they may have family members who don't go to their church, but they're more likely to have that closed triangle between that non-church relationship and the church relationship. So their friends become friends, even though they come from sort of different spheres of life. And it turns out, it seems like that's one of the major findings from that site, that evangelicals actually do show much more of this triad closure pattern outside their congregation. We also expected, though, that there could be a pattern that differs regionally or could differ geographically. So one of the things that we looked into was in more urban contexts, we have reason to believe that the different institutions that people use to meet their needs, the different types of institutions that people frequent, are more separate or autonomous from one another than they would be in sort of small towns. You could think of a sort of traditional small town where maybe you know, the local church minister serves on the school board, so, you know, he has a connection to the educational institution. Maybe he's the hospital chapel, so there's a sort of connection to the medical institution. You know, maybe the local restaurant sponsors a Little League team and donates desserts to the church picnic. So there's this sort of overlap between these various sort of social institutions. What a lot of sociologists of modernization point to is that in more modernized, urban, sort of more densely populated contexts, we sort of see the separation of different social institutions so that there's sort of an autonomy. Church doesn't have as much overlap with medical institutions in town or with perhaps the educational institutions. There's more of a separation. And so if you buy that argument, if you think that there is more social differentiation between these institutions, then it might make sense that people who live in more urban contexts and go to church, they don't necessarily have that sort of easy access to sort of linking together people that they know from various spheres of life, the workplace, church, sports, whatever. These sort of institutions are more separated, they're more autonomous from one another, and there's not sort of the sort of easy access between institutions that you might have, say, in a small town or a more rural type of area. And that's one of the patterns we see as well. So people that are churchgoers in urban contexts tend not to show as much of this overlap in their networks between their church life and their non-church life.
It's interesting finding. I gravitated toward the urban-rural divide to some extent because I work in a urban area and at a university that has a, I think even the staff and faculty on the university outnumber the people in the town that I live in. It's a small town of about 7,500 people. And at first I thought, oh, you know, the triadic closure, making these triangles would be easier where there's lots of people you're running into. But then I thought, oh, no, in a small town, I kind of run into everybody and everybody kind of knows everybody else, even 7,000 people or so. But then I thought, well, at my university, boy, I don't know anybody in history and they're like in the building connected to me. So, well, I'm not closing any triads here or anything.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect example of sort of institutional differentiation thesis.
Yeah, no, that's kind of interesting. The other thing that you do, and earlier I mentioned that you focused on traditionalists here, but this study you broke down into mainline Protestants, evangelicals, Black Protestants, and Catholics. Why did you choose those breakdowns instead of the traditionalists like you did in the previous paper?
Yeah, well, in this case, more or less it just kind of was built around the sort of way that the data were collected and the questions that were asked of these respondents. So they asked people, sort of classifying people by religion has sort of been a sort of longstanding piece of arts and sort of combination of art and science, I guess, to try to figure out the best way to concisely piece people together in sort of meaningful categories for religion. That's one of the things that's so fascinating, I think, about American religiosity is there's so many different strains of religion, so many different flavors and variations. And so trying to categorize people into meaningful groups has really been a challenge for a long time. So I use this sort of way of categorizing that's been pretty popular and pretty widely used in the sociology of religion that sort of asks people, first of all, what's your religious affiliation? And people could have any number of open-ended responses for that, you know, everything from, Church of Christ, Southern Baptist, Reformed Presbyterian, on down to Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, whatever people sort of report as their religious preference, then they then sort of fall into these different categories. And so we have ways of kind of putting together evangelical types of churches as ones that, again, would kind of fall more in line with some of the sort of traditionalist tenets that we talked about before in terms of doctrine and in terms of their belief, their theological belief. And then we have ways of kind of putting people into sort of this grab bag other categories. So somebody said they were Church of the Jedi or Flying Spaghetti Monster, they would probably fall into the sort of other category. I didn't look at the others because that is sort of such an idiosyncratic group of many religious traditions. It's hard to sort of find any common thread between them. So I really focused on the sort of main branches of American, specifically Christianity, and really why I focused on Christianity in this particular piece was because there just weren't really enough big enough size groups, say of Jews or Muslims in the sample that would really allow me to make valid comparisons. So I looked specifically just at evangelicals, mainline Protestants, Catholics, and Black Protestants.
And again, how does it shake out in your results? Who are the bestest at closing these triads?
Well, yeah, the one that sort of jumps out the most is the comparison between evangelical Protestants and mainline Protestants. Evangelical Protestants have much higher odds of showing this pattern than mainline Protestants. I believe that it's about, if you just look simply at whether or not you have at least one case of this triadic closure, this transitivity in your network, it would be about 74% among Protestants that show this pattern, or I'm sorry, evangelical Protestants, and then if you compare that to mainline or Protestants, it's somewhere in the mid-50s, like 55-56%. So quite a jump. You know, it shows you that even among mainline Protestants, where it's relatively less, you still see more than half of those congregants from mainline churches that show this triad closure pattern, right, where they connect friends from inside their church to outside. But you're talking about 20 percentage points higher among people that are the evangelical Protestants.
I can't remember the paper, but did you look at non-religious in there too?
No, so these were, okay. This specifically was among congregationalists. So really the only way you could be eligible for connecting a church friend with a non-church friend is if you are part of a congregation.
Yeah. That makes sense. So give us your read on that. Why do you think the evangelicals are about 20 percentage points or so better at closing these triads?
Well, I think maybe part of it goes to what you mentioned a few minutes ago. You cited your example of, you know, the church context where you're in, where the minister is encouraging people to go out and, you know, make friends at the gym, make friends at the workplace, you know, bring people into the fold, perhaps. That's a big emphasis in evangelical circles, right, yeah. To sort of grow the church, build the flock, bring newcomers in to church who maybe aren't currently going to church or maybe are dissatisfied with their current church situation. And so, you know, if that's the sort of message to reaching out to people, you know, one way you could try to do that is just sort of on your own, right? You could sort of go out and, you know, meet your neighbor and just sort of keep asking your neighbor, want to come to church with me? You know, would you like to join my church? Would you like to come visit the church? But another way that sort of evangelicals might do this sort of evangelism is the sort of triadic form of evangelism, where they might have a friend who's also a church member, another part of their congregation, who they introduce to their neighbor or their non-church friends, say at a picnic or at a birthday party or through some kind of other event where they're bringing these people together. And now you've sort of got a much easier, maybe a much more seamless way to sort of try to bring other people into the fold. If evangelicals are known for evangelism, it can really be helpful if you sort of have already embedded somebody into sort of a mini community, and you and your friend together can sort of get to know that individual and sort of coax them in to coming to the church or to joining. And maybe that's one read on what's happening with evangelicals, that they sort of are taking seriously this idea of bringing others into the fold, and they're sort of doing it in a sort of triangle way. That's potentially, I think, one explanation. Another one is this emphasis in a lot of evangelical circles about sort of authenticity, the idea that church life isn't something that should be sequestered and sort of cordoned off from the rest of your life, that sort of who you are at church is who you are on, you know, Monday through Saturday. And so if you sort of, you know, buy into this idea of authenticity and sort of bringing your whole life together and not sort of segmenting it into different parts, it would make sense that sort of people who are your co-congregants would get to know people who you know from other spheres of your life. You might meet up at the local pub for drinks. You might invite them to your birthday party or your kids' functions, and they sort of get to know each other that way. So that might be another potential explanation for why evangelicals look that way.
Yeah, again, I'm one of these nuts and bolts people, and I like to think about how this plays out on a day-to-day basis. And I know a lot of evangelical churches emphasize small groups that are meeting on a Wednesday or a Thursday night, and they're usually organized around some kind of special interest, like horseback riding or knitting or a book club. Some of them are strictly Bible school or Bible studies, but you know, I can see the triads starting to connect because, you know, you have a horseback riding small group in your congregation, and you know somebody else who likes horses. They're not part of your church. They say, hey, we're going out for a ride on Saturday morning. You want to come along? And, you know, all of a sudden the opportunities for triangulating or closing that triangle actually appear.
Yeah, that's a great example. I think maybe even the best example of the way that sort of evangelical churches have sort of caught this vision is the sort of the movement of the sort of evangelical megachurch that has sort of found human needs, things that interest people, and has sort of tried to bring that into the church, right? Whether it's sports leagues or fitness centers or coffee shops or these other sort of innovations that have happened, especially in mega churches and especially small groups, like you mentioned. You know, those provide sort of fitting opportunities, sort of easy, seamless opportunities to sort of get together with both church people and non-church people in a sort of non-threatening way and to sort of ease them into finding out what the church is all about. So I think that's one of the sort of organizational dynamics that sort of certainly is, maybe they have used the word trans-congregational triad enclosure, but they're sort of doing that implicitly. That's sort of the mindset.
Now, we have only a couple minutes left, but one of the reasons why you have over 4 dozen articles and you're such a publishing machine is that you make such great use of these data sets that you come across and you can think of really interesting questions. One other paper that I read recently by you is one that deals with these networks in prayer for other people. That's what I'm going to call it. Give us a quick summary of what you found there.
Yeah, so intercessory prayer. I guess to work on these titles, they kind of trip up the tongue.
I know.
So there's sort of, sociologists who study networks and social support have sort of done a good job, I think, over the years of chronicling many different types of support that people can get from network members, whether it's, like in this other study, sharing money, giving money to someone, helping with advice, helping with practical assistance, doing all these things. And people put together these sort of lists of social support that gets transmitted in social networks. But one of the things I thought was a sort of major gap is that, again, going back to this idea that social scientists oftentimes just sort of see religious things and religiosity as sort of on the periphery of their concerns or their interests, is that few people have actually thought about prayer as a really potentially powerful form of social support that you could get from people in your network. And again, here I'm sort of playing the part of the salesman for this Portraits of American Life survey. I really think it is a pretty brilliant survey. It's a lot of these really interesting topics covered. And so, again, kudos to the folks who developed the survey. But they asked about this issue. People in your networks, who are the people that have prayed for you or have told you they've prayed for you in the past 3 years? And so this sort of gives you another way to look at a form of social support that's not oftentimes considered in social science. And I was interested in this idea of, if you know someone is praying for, if you said someone is praying for you, is that associated with certain aspects of your well-being? And one of the tricky things, I think, about asking this sort of question, there's maybe a number of things that are kind of tricky about asking the question, but maybe the most important issue is that oftentimes people tell you they're praying for you when bad things happen, right? When a financial difficulty comes, when there's a marital breakup, when there's, maybe you're evicted from your home, all these kind of trials of life are usually occasions that prompt prayer to begin with, intercessory prayer, praying for another person. And so I wanted to look at a sort of aspect of well-being that might transcend the sort of moment right now when people may be needing prayer, but actually looks towards the future. And so I was kind of interested in people's optimism towards the future. Do they think things are going to get better in the near future? And so I looked at whether people who reported that they had at least one network tie that said they prayed for them, and whether there was multiple network ties who reported praying for that person. And it turned out that this isn't a causal relationship, but at least there was an association that showed that if you did have more people report praying for you, or at least one person report praying for you, you were more likely to report a higher sense of optimism for the future. And that relationship became particularly strong when you accounted for difficulties that people have experienced in the past several years, whether they've lost a job or had some kind of a marital problem or a family issue. That actually really came forward and showed why it was the case that you felt more optimistic towards the future. And what was interesting too about this was that it seemed like it wasn't necessarily only an association that held among highly religious people. So you might expect, if you're an avid churchgoer, if you yourself are highly religious, oh great, people in the fold are praying for me. I might feel that this is going to bode well for me. But even for people that were relatively non-religious or less religious comparatively, they also tended to themselves seem to have this association with higher sense of optimism if they knew that people in their network were praying for them.
Yeah, no, absolutely interesting findings. Just having somebody on your side, be it God or for you atheists who might not believe in that, just somebody saying, hey, I'm thinking good thoughts for you today and we're going to get through this issue. It does create optimism. And again, that's a very pro-social behavior that can connect people through a lot of networks. So great research that you're doing out there. We will link to your website, which will have a list of all the articles that you've written, and some of you folks who have access to these journals via universities or other sources might be able to get a chance to read some of them, because they're really good. Not only do you learn these cool phrases, trans-congregational triadic closures, but the findings are just absolutely fantastic as well. So my guest today has been Marcus Schaefer. Marcus, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.